Good morning. I'd like to get started. Good morning and welcome to today's installment of the Research for the Real World. This is NIJ's Translational Criminology Seminar Series, and this is the kickoff for the fall season. My name is John Lobb, and I'm the director of the National Institute of Justice, and I want to thank you all for being here this morning. As you know, today's presentation titled Reforming New Orleans Criminal Justice System, the Role of Data and Research, will feature Dr. Michael Jacobson from the Vera Institute of Justice. In this presentation, Dr. Jacobson will discuss the organization's work with the City of New Orleans, how they track vital criminal justice statistics, and how they use this empirical information as the basis for policy reform, development, and implementation following Hurricane Katrina. Now, it is my pleasure to introduce Dr. Michael Jacobson. Dr. Michael Jacobson joined the Vera Institute as the fourth director in January 2005. He's a sociologist by training with a career that spanned both academia and government service. He's taught at John Jay College of Criminal Justice in the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. In addition, Dr. Jacobson has served the City of New York as Corrections Commissioner, Probation Commissioner, and Deputy Budget Director. In October 2010, Dr. Jacobson was appointed to the New York State Permanent Sentencing Commission by the Chief Judge of New York State. Given Dr. Jacobson's experience as both a researcher and a practitioner, I'm sure he will speak to the heart of translational criminology and how to use research to inform practice and policy. Indeed, the reason that this lecture series exists. Through telling us how he used data and research to improve the criminal justice system in New Orleans, I hope all of us will gain useful information that we could in turn take back to our agencies and organizations. Now, it's very rare that the Research for the Real World is able to attract somebody who is not only a strong academic, a strong person with respect to policy and practice, but also somewhat of a media rock star. For those of you like me that watch C-SPAN, Michael appeared on C-SPAN in, let me get the dates right here, February 13th, talking about state prison funding. On May 4th, 2012, he also appeared on C-SPAN along with James Lynch from the Bureau of Justice Statistics talking about U.S. prison population trends. And finally, most of all, he appeared on April 22nd on the CBS Sunday Morning News talking about the costs of prison. I understand there's a film in the works for the fall and who knows what else, and maybe he'll be at the film festival in Colorado next year. So with that, Michael Jacobson.
Thank you, John, and good morning, everybody. Thanks for having me here. I'm just going to get my notes. This will be probably, in some ways, not quite the usual talk that's given in these series. I think for a couple of reasons. One, obvious one. I'm not going to use PowerPoint. You're welcome. And two, I decided to talk about our work in New Orleans for a few reasons, hopefully some of which will be obvious by the time I end my talk. I could have talked, Vera is an interesting place. We do work all over the country. We do some very rigorous sort of social science research, technical assistance. You know, we have projects that from a research point of view are certainly more sophisticated than the work we've, certainly the empirical work we've done in New Orleans. And I'm going to talk a little about, just from a comparison point of view, some of the work we've done in Los Angeles, which is a more really sort of rigorous, huge administrative data sort of research project. But one of the reasons I decided to talk about New Orleans, even though the pure research work we've done there, doesn't measure up to, sort of peer review kind of research, it is a really interesting mix of sort of policy work, technical assistance, on the ground facilitation, and research, all in the sort of furtherance of moving reform in New Orleans. So I'm going to try to do a few things in this presentation. And I know we have 90 minutes. I plan to talk for all 90 of those minutes. I'm not taking any annoying, difficult questions. I'm going right to the end. No, okay, not really. But so I'm going to make a case certainly for projects like New Orleans that for the kind of work we do, for the sort of research and data analysis we've done, certainly in that sort of context, that work, the research in and of itself is a necessary but not remotely sort of sufficient part of moving along reform, right? Incredibly important, certainly in a case like New Orleans, to use that research in the context of a very long history, some really interesting, long-standing politics, criminal justice system that evolved out of the Napoleonic Code, and just providing research, just talking about research, again, hugely important, but would never, ever be enough to sort of move along, to move that along. And again, that's in the context overall of a criminal justice system, largely, certainly on the corrections and policy and punishment side, that's been immune to research for decades, right? I mean, if we had a system that was based on research, it wouldn't look like the way it looks now, right? So that's beginning to change largely, right? Research and evidence-based, and you can't shake a stick at a state legislature now without hearing about evidence-based programs, and that's, it's not all good, but it's mostly good. It's nice that the field is paying attention to evidence, but it doesn't have a, in the last 40 years, it's not that the field of criminal justice policy does not have a vainglorious history of being driven by research. But again, I think that's certainly changing over the last decade or so, and I think will change for the better, even more going forward. So I'm going to talk a little about the research, the context we did that research in New Orleans. I'm going to compare it a little to Los Angeles because there we've done pretty significant and substantive work and ongoing work in both those cities, some interesting commonalities and some differences, and then I'll sort of end with at least for Vera what have been some of the lessons in doing that work. First, though, I think it probably makes sense to give you some context of how we appeared in New Orleans in the first place, and what the sort of environment was for us doing the work we do, and how we did it. So let me just do a few minutes of that sort of backdrop narrative that will give you some sense as I start to yak about this more of how we wound up there and what we do. So right after Katrina, literally in the couple of months after Katrina, I got a phone call from a guy who was a newly elected city council person. His name was James Carter. He's now the criminal justice coordinator in New Orleans. He's the highest official that works for Mayor Landrieu on criminal justice issues. But in 2006, he was a newly elected council person, and one of those folks. He was an attorney and a defense attorney, and Katrina helped sort of politicize him, as it did a number of folks in New Orleans. And when he came onto the council, he sort of quickly realized, both substantively and politically, he sort of needed, he needed an issue. He needed something that was going to sort of distinguish him somehow. And he quickly realized that that issue for him was going to be criminal justice. And he called me, and he sort of introduced himself. And, he is, and some of you, I'm sure, may have met him. He's a very interesting, very charismatic guy. And he sort of launched into this speech about how he was a new councilman, how he was going to be in charge of the Criminal Justice Committee for the City Council of New Orleans. And while there was all this pressure in New Orleans to rebuild and to rebuild, to levels of pre-Katrina and housing and infrastructure, he was determined that New Orleans not rebuild to the criminal justice system that operated in New Orleans pre-Katrina, right? That this was, trite as it may be, right, that Katrina really was an opportunity to sort of reimagine and reform its criminal justice system, and he was going to take the lead. From his point of view, you know, the president of the United States wasn't dealing with that issue. The governor of Louisiana wasn't dealing with that issue. The then mayor of New Orleans wasn't dealing with that issue. And so he was going to deal with it, and he was going to get it done, and he was going to reform. And he gave this it's a 10-minute passionate speech, after which I don't remember exactly what I said, but it was something like, who are you? It was a great speech, but I said, but you're just a new city council person. Like, how do you have the juice to get any of this done? And he said, look, I'm committed to doing it. I'll raise some money for Vera to come in initially and do sort of a high level look at our system and at least give us some guidance about what, given the lack of infrastructure, the lack of resources, what all our problems are, give us some guidance as to the big areas we should really, we know we can't turn the system around overnight, but come in and help us sort of pinpoint what specific reform areas should be. That's what I need you to do. And so, he was very convincing, very persuasive guy. So we got a little bit of funding, and we went down, and we spent about a month there, and we did a report that's on our website if people want to see it. And it was sort of a high level report, and it pinpointed several things about the New Orleans system that were sort of either obvious gaps in their system or just, if they were in a gap, they were broken in some really fundamental way. And so I want to go through a few of them now, and then I'll talk about a few of the specific areas we worked on in the role of sort of research and data analysis. We found four to five areas that we thought in the next few years, in order to have a well-functioning criminal justice system, the city had to fix as soon as it possibly could. One is, there was no pretrial system at all. There was no such thing as release on recognizance in New Orleans. There's no sorting or interviewing of defendants. There's no capacity. There is now, but there has no historical capacity to do that kind of work. It's a money bail system. If you get arrested in New Orleans, and by the way, if you take anything from this lecture at all, in one smidgen of information, don't get arrested in New Orleans. And New Orleans Police Department is a very, very high volume arrest police department. They were, they still are. I live in New York City. We tend to think of the NYPD as a high volume arrest department. The NOPD arrests about three times per capita what the NYPD arrests. They have hugely high arrest rates, and it is purely a money bail system. Everyone gets money bail. No one gets ROR. I should say that's not quite true. The only way historically you could get released on recognizance in New Orleans is if a private attorney, and it has to be a private attorney, it cannot be a public defender, if a private attorney calls a judge and makes a case for his client to be released on recognizance, he may or may not get ROR, but that's the only way you can get ROR. And that's one of the reasons, certainly at the time, that New Orleans had, and haven't looked at these figures lately, probably still continues to have, the highest local incarceration rate in U.S., which means the world. Not solely, but largely because of that flow into the jail with no one getting released. So that was just a huge part of the system, a huge piece of sort of best practice that was obviously missing. And so that's one area we highlighted, and I'll talk about it in a little more detail in a couple of minutes. The other, which was actually the first thing we worked on, which I'll also talk a little more about in a couple of minutes, was that codified into Louisiana law and practiced by New Orleans, if you are arrested for a misdemeanor, and detained, the DA has 45 days in which to file a formal charge and 60 days for a felony. So that is, once you're in jail for a misdemeanor or a felony, you're not pre-trial, you're pre-charge, right? You can, and historically people have, stayed for 45 days for a misdemeanor, 60 days for a felony, before formal charge is even filed. You know, I've been around, I've seen a lot of stuff, I'm a pretty cynical person. It's always amazing when you can find something new that you never thought of. People ask me about the constitutionality of that all the time. I'm sure there have been challenges to it before. It still exists. So that was sort of an odd one. That, you know, we're on the jail side now. That was just a huge issue for us, right? People not only were not sorted out, were not released on recognizance, but once you were in, you were in. And most of those folks, especially on the misdemeanor side, stayed more time than they would ever have stayed if they got sentenced to whatever they were there for, right? It was just an obvious thing that they had to look at. The other thing we wanted them to look at was the use of summonses in lieu of arrests. As I said before, the NOPD is a hugely high volume. I think that will change over time, especially because the mayor and Ron Serpas, who's the police commissioner, are, I think, pretty determined to change that. And I think the consent decree they have will probably force them to change even more, but especially on low-level, nonviolent sort of quality of life arrests. Although they had the ability to use summonses, they did not use summonses, right? They just used custodial arrests, which to us made no sense. And again, given that system, those folks would be there for 45. Once they are in, they were there for 45 days, never even with the possibility of getting a 45-day sentence on what they did. And so we thought they should take advantage of being much more aggressive on using summonses. The other thing that was apparent, and I'll get into some of the specific work now, essentially no alternatives to incarceration or detention. Hugely little capacity. The DA has some diversion programs in his office, but no sort of structural ability to do alternatives to incarceration or detention. And also, not surprisingly, especially given the population and the hugely concentrated poverty in New Orleans and the high volume of arrests, right? You put that together, you know you're going to have incredibly high rates of mental illness and drug use, people coming into the jail system, not an unusual state of affairs for any city correction system, even more pronounced in New Orleans, based, again, just because it's so poor, so much volume coming in, the rates are really high, and in their case, matched with next to no capacity to deliver those services. Mental health services, drug treatment, sorely lacking in New Orleans. I mean, it's not, a lot of cities have problems with that sort of capacity. That's not unusual. New Orleans is a sort of one end of that bell curve. I mean, they have very, very little capacity. A lot of people there working to change that now. I'm sort of confident it will change, but that was another area we thought they needed to work on quickly in terms of system issues. There were a couple of others, but I'll just stop with them. You could tell the system in some very fundamental ways was just not a functioning system. And so we did our report. We suggested they reform those areas. The city council sort of adopted our report as their official roadmap to criminal justice reform. The city council sort of said to Vera, well, you know, so that, come on down. You know, you need to do this now. And, you know, we had some interesting conversations, the gist of which was, well, you know, no, you need to do this. Like, we can help you do it, but we cannot come down to New Orleans and you know, fix your criminal justice system, you have to fix your criminal justice system. We can provide all sorts of assistance, facilitation assistance, research assistance, you know, best practice stuff. We can do a lot of stuff, but you have to do it. And, you know, at the time, these were very interesting conversations, both within VERA and with national funders, because it was, you know, right after Katrina. And, you know, the city at some level was asking us to come down and help. And at one level, this is the kind of thing that VERA lives for, right? I mean, of course you want to help. It's look at that system. Even if you do a little, even if you just do a little bit, you're doing a lot for a lot of people. So at some level, we wanted to help. You know, we had a lot of people telling us, you know, national funders, you know, people who are, you know, serious, politically astute folks saying, do not go down there. You know, if you invest resources there, I understand that, you know, why you would want to, but you will disappear down a black hole of politics that you will never understand. You will never be seen again. That scared me a little. And so, you know, we had this conversation with the city, and, you know, it took the form of, well, look, you know, we really want to provide assistance, and we're willing to make a, you know, a real commitment to the city. We, you know, are very fond of the city, the people there, the people in government, and the citizens. We said, but, you know, you have to do this. You, the city, you have to get together and do this. And James Carter, sort of, I think, you know, he's a very astute guy. He kind of got that, and he said, okay, I will get everyone in the city to sign on to all these reforms. Everyone, every criminal justice leader is going to sign on to this. And again, I don't remember what I said. It was probably a little more colorful than what I'm about to say, but it was something along the lines of, are you out of your mind? You know, I mean, how are you going to do that? And he said, I'm going to do it. You know, I'm going to do it. I need your help. I'm going to have a 2-day retreat what wound up to be Point Clear, the Redneck Riviera. Who knows? It's very nice. And, you know, I'm going to get all those. I'm going to get everyone there. And after 2 days, everyone is going to sign on to this reform. I said, okie dokie. But, you know, we really wanted to help. It's not like I'd bore you with the details. The details are probably more interesting than the rest of my presentation. But we had this 2-day retreat. He got everyone down there because he had enough political. He did in fact have enough political juice to do that. At the beginning of that retreat, he said to, there was a room like this, and, you know, all the leaders were there with their, you know, the principals were there with a lot of their staff, and he said, you know, in my position, okay, here's why we're here. You know, VERA did this report. You've all read it. If you haven't, here's what it said. You know, we need to reform A, B, C, and D. And by the time we leave, everyone here is going to sign a document that says you are now committed to getting this reform done. To say that was not warmly received would be an understatement. You know, no one, you know, both on the substance, but, you know, no one, no official, no policymaker, no elected official likes to be told they're going to sign anything, right? That's not, you know, tell me I'm going to sign something. I'll sign something if I want to sign something. And I'm certainly not signing that. And 2 days later, they all signed it, all of them. And there was a, not only did they all sign it, there was a very sort of high-profile media event in the mayor's office with the mayor. Got a lot of press. They, you know, all came up and signed this very official-looking document committing to reform everyone. The sheriff, the mayor, the city council, the police commissioner, the courts, the public defender, the DA, everyone. And that's a testament, and in some ways a lesson from this, to the what will eventually become the larger local leadership. But in that case, you know, it's one person who just had this vision and was determined to make it happen. And so what happened after that was that all those principles formed, that the signing of the document sort of created this organization called the Criminal Justice Leadership Alliance. That's the group that we now do all our work through. And simply, it's just a collection of all the criminal justice and leaders and mayor in the city of New Orleans, right? That's the group that committed to do all these reforms. There are now subgroups of that group that work on specific areas of reform. And once they formed that group, the city committed to reform, that's initially when national funders started to come in to fund the work, right? Because we approach a lot of national funders at earlier stages saying, look, the city wants help. We'd like to help them. You know, is this the kind of thing you'll fund? No. No, everyone said no. No, we are not, you know, because at least if we give money to Kansas, we kind of know where it's going to go. We know what's going to happen. You know, we are not just shoveling money into New Orleans. Because, you know, who knows? But when we came back with this sort of leadership alliance and this large commitment, at that point, it was enough for Vera to make the institutional commitment we did, and it was enough for the funders to start funding. And so we got initial funding from the Jet Foundation, God rest their souls, Baptist Community Ministries, which is a big local funder in New Orleans, the Open Society Foundation, Ford, and then the latest from the Bureau of Justice Assistance at DOJ. So we made this commitment to the city, and one of the commitments we made is it was clear to us if we were going to help the city move this reform along, we were going to have staff there all the time. I mean, there was no way, and you know, we have, and I'm sure a lot of you are involved in engagements like this all the time. We have different engagements where we sort of come in and out of places. We help people move stuff along. We do some work. We leave. We come back. We talk to them on the phone. I mean, they can be pretty intense, but we're not there. We knew that that would never work in New Orleans. We knew we had to be there, and so we relocated staff there and opened our small office. And we knew there'd be a number of, you know, I mean, almost too many challenges to even contemplate. We knew one of them was going to be data. Their data is horrible. You know, it's never easy to get good, clean data anywhere. This is really, really a challenge. I'm going to take out my BlackBerry, not because I'm going to tweet thousands of my followers now, but I asked John Wool, who's the director of our New Orleans office, to just, you know, send me a sentence or two on the data there, so I could, you know, describe it in a way that, you know, people who are sophisticated in data would understand, but without taking sort of 10 minutes. And he sent me this, and I can't. The best thing for me to do is just read it, I think, and you'll get a sense. Okay. So I asked John, you know, just give me a sentence or two that describes the various data challenges. I'll just read this to you. I'm not sure I can sensibly string even random thoughts together as I started the day at 5:15 in the jail. And staff is always whining about how hard they work. But perhaps this is the best state to try to explain the criminal justice data system here. For historical reasons, unrelated to anything a researcher might be concerned with, the court's data is funneled back to the sheriff's database, which also holds all jail-related data. The sheriff, an independently elected official, the sheriff controls 90% of the data that does exist in New Orleans. Both in the sheriff's antiquated green screen AS-400, there's a blast from the past, AS-400 system and the court system, there are significant completeness and accuracy problems, and perhaps most importantly, programming the system to run queries that join data points is seen as akin to asking a 90-year-old man to walk up 6 flights of stairs. Everyone fears a fatal crash. Moreover, much of the data is entered in text fields rather than delimited fields, and searching becomes arduous. One example, our pretrial services program, which foremost needs to be able to identify court decisions about detention or release, has, after more than a year, not been able to identify a field that specifies what the detention release decision is. Although it is in there somewhere in every case, both the court and particularly the jailer need to know if the person is supposed to be in custody or not. NOPD has some data, not nearly enough. The DA has next to no data system. Oh, and the two courts, the state court and the municipal court, do not share data. We're the only people who can tell the state court that their felony defendant has an open misdemeanor in a municipal court and vice versa. And we have to look up individual by individual. There seems to be no current way to merge the two databases to do this. I'm going to sleep. It's really poor data to work with. And since we sort of pride ourselves on being a sort of empirically based organization that uses data to further reform, right, this has been a huge challenge to us. And so I'm going to run through quickly how we've been able to use data in the furtherance of that reform. It's not the use of data that in any way, shape, or form is something that NIJ would fund as a research project, right? That mean you just never even consider it, and understandably so. You know, maybe one day there'll be systems there that will allow such funding, but right now they're not. And so one of our challenges has been, frankly, how to use, you know, what does it mean to use research and data to push reform in a system that, I mean, it's a little strong to say they have no data, but their data is a really limited value. And so one of the things we've done is rely on sort of national best practice, meta-analyses, you know, other research that's been done on similar issues, and we've managed to use, I think, pretty successfully their data in a way to paint a picture, to tell a story, to sort of complete a narrative, and to really be sort of descriptive of a system that, you know, we find that stuff pretty useful, even though people, you know, they've been in these systems forever, they've run them forever, they don't really know at any level of detail how people flow through, how long they stay, at what cost, at what risk. And so we have used that data as a way to sort of illuminate some of those things, and that's really helped. So I'm going to run through how we sort of worked on some of those issues and the role of data in the next few minutes, compared a little to Los Angeles, and then talk about some of the lessons. So the first thing we took on was what we called expedited charging. That is getting the time down from 45 days to file a misdemeanor charge to 60 days to file a felony charge. And, you know, one of the, you know, these were, and it goes to show you that, you know, even though this group, the Leadership Alliance signed off on all these reforms, they did it for a variety of reasons. For political reasons, they felt they sort of had to, for peer pressure, because they believed in it. I mean, it's sort of all over the map. But, you know, when you really start to drill down and say, okay, we're now you all signed on, we're going to get rid of this 45 and 60 days, right? Our goal is going to be, I think we said 6 days. I'm not sure why we said 6 days exactly. You know, we went through with the group, and I mentioned this to someone before, you know, we talk about what happens in other cities. You know, one of the rules of this kind of consulting, one of the ironclad rules is, no matter where you are, but certainly if you're in the South, don't ever talk about New York City, right? No one cares, has no relevance to anyone's life. It means nothing. And, you know, we sort of get that, but, you know, we do use New York and Chicago and LA, you know, just as a guide to other things that, you know, that can happen. You know, in New York City and other big cities, that charging decision is made, you know, most of the time within 24 hours, other cities, 48 hours. You know, when we started to have that talk with that group, even though they all sort of signed on to it, you know, it was at that point, I think, that they realized, oh my God, you know, first of all, do we really want to do this? You know, because there's, you know, both a sense that that's how they've done it forever, and there were 100 practical reasons why you couldn't get that time down. It just had to take that much time. That's what it took naturally. And also, it wasn't just an undercurrent, it was a stated current, a feeling among many of the actors that, well, what's wrong with that? You know, if these guys are in, they're not going to wreak havoc. If they're in, they're in. You know, and you say, yeah, but... They're not even charged with a crime. You know, it's United States of America. I mean, you can't, you know, you have to charge them. You can keep them in if you charge them and you decide they, you know, their risk level, but you can't. I mean, they can because it's the law, but, you know, you can't keep people for, you know, for 60 days. And, you know, the case we made to them, and, you know, that a lot of them, to their credit, saw, was that on both ends of that scale, what would happen is people would be in for 45 days, right? So it would mean that the first time the DA and police would talk to each other would be on the 44th day. That's what happened. They would never talk. The 44th day, they talk, and they'd go over the cases, and they realized, you know, for almost all of them, this is a crap case. Let them go. Right, so they wouldn't even file charges, right? And so, you know, the case we tried to make was, well, why wouldn't you want to have that discussion, you know, 30 days before? Why are you having this discussion now? Whose interest is served by that time? I mean, even you folks think that this is a case that doesn't belong here. But on the other end, on the felonies, what would happen is the 59th day is the first time they would talk. And for a lot of those cases, right, they have a serious crime problem in New Orleans, right? It's a, you know, there's a serious violent crime problem. They got some serious people in jail. For a lot of those cases, they'd realize, oh my God, this is a serious guy, right? Maybe we should have talked, you know, maybe we should have done something in those 59 days to sort of get some evidence, to build some case. Now we don't have enough to charge him. We got to let him go, right? So both you were, you know, it was a process of sort of convincing them that both on the low end, right, they had cases that even they think shouldn't have been there at what for them is great cost. And on the serious end, they were letting violent felons go because they hadn't moved that time up. And so those were very difficult conversations. You know, coming from a liberal place like New York, you know, this has existed for so long. And, you know, I'm sure at some point these were, you know, they were similar difficult conversations in New York as well. But they were very difficult conversations. But like a lot of the work we do, we sort of convince them to just, let's just try it. You know what? Let's see how it goes. And when you get into the reason we can't do it is because when the police change tours, the paper moves from here to here. How are we going to get the paper down there? We don't even have a fax machine. We'll buy you a fax machine, right? What else? Well, you know, the clerks, they sit over there. I mean, it's all that, you know, when you're in those kinds of discussions, you know that you're going to make some progress because all that sort of stuff you can deal with. And so, again, sparing you a lot of the details, because this kind of data we were able to track, right? We did know who was in from the sheriff's data, who was in for what charge, for how long. And so we could track almost on a daily basis how long those pretrial charging decisions took. We just started to do things like, and this is sort of why we had to be there on the ground. I mean, literally, the people in our office were installing fax machines, running back and forth to the office, talking to the police officers and the clerks about how the paper was going to move from there to there, running to the DA's office to make sure there was someone on the other side, getting that police report, making sure there were then meetings, scheduling meetings with, you know, you wouldn't think you graduate law school or get a PhD, this is what you're going to do with your life, but apparently it is. And, you know, like a lot of these reforms, once you do it, you sort of start to see the utility in it, right? I mean, DAs would get the stuff early. They kind of liked that. The police would sort of get it out. You know, they weren't doing any more work. They were just kind of moving up the clock. And so, you know, again, long story short, as soon as it started to happen with, you know, very little technology, really, you know, very little real reform other than moving up those decisions and moving up some paperwork, right, those times, I think I wrote them down, the filing of charges have gone from an average of 61 days up to 6 days, and arrest arraignment for those detained has gone from 64 days to 11 days. So, you know, it's still 11 days. It's not great, you know. It's still 6 days. There's really no reason you can't do it in 24 hours, so we're still pushing. But again, once everyone got there, right, that's a substantial piece of reform for that system. It's of some level it's an inside baseball kind of reform, but that little piece of reform affects the lives of thousands of people who now stay far less in jail than they would have. You know, We used a lot of descriptive data for that, a lot of sort of research on best practices, a lot of, bringing in, we took trips to other jurisdictions, and people saw how complaint rooms were. I mean, it was a lot of, it doesn't quite fall under the rubric of research, but it was, it was using research that already existed, a lot of national best practice stuff, and that was really useful. And what we found in a tremendous amount of our work is that, not only sort of research and data and, all that stuff that is so important, but, people like to talk to their peers. It's one thing, and it's useful to talk to, the bunch of smarty pants researchers at NIJ or VIRA, the Urban Institute, or, but legislators like to talk to legislators, right? DAs like to talk to DAs. It's not even an R&D thing, right? People just like to talk to people who, at least at some level, are in their shoes, right? And so, even though I used to do that stuff and I ran a correction agency, they want to, you don't understand what I do. I do all these political things I have to deal with. What do you know? You're just some sociologist who, wants us to change. And so we use a lot of that in our work, right? We bring people out to other places. We bring DAs, and whether it's legislators or DAs or police chiefs, whatever, for discussions we have with VIRA, what we call sort of associates. These are current practitioners who, are not kind enough to give us like 4 to 6 days of their time a year for these kind of engagements. So, all that sort of factored into this, the expedited charging thing, but that's all sort of common to the changes we made in other areas. And the summonses area, again, that's an area where we didn't have great data. You couldn't do anything fancy with the data we have, but we did at least know how many arrests there were, how many were summons eligible, and how many summonses there were. And for that one, we had another working group. And again, I can't stress enough that Criminal Justice Leadership Alliance, even though it's, it's not like everyone's on the same page, no one's, everyone's not holding hands, singing kumbaya, marching to the same tune, right? It's not that. But it is a group of people who have all committed at some level to working together. And that doesn't mean they all agree on any of these reforms, but they're at the table talking about it, right? No one's back channeling, no one's going to the press. That's an old New Orleans tradition, right? The DA, if you go back and do a, here's a dissertation, go back and do some content analysis of the Times-Picayune coverage of the New Orleans criminal justice system over 5 years. The police chief would have a press conference blasting the DA. The DA would never, it was the Wild West, really, and that just doesn't happen anymore, right? I mean, everyone has those arguments sort of through this leadership alliance, and it's hugely important, and to their credit, that they, this is not easy for them to do. They all take some level of political risk. They all are at least willing to cede some authority, to cede some budget, I mean, depending on what's happening. And, it's not easy for policymakers and elected officials to do this. On the summons issue, the NOPD was right there. The city council really wanted to push this issue of not making custodial arrests for things that were clearly summons eligible. And, in New Orleans, what happens is that if you are if you're given a summons, if you're arrested, along with the arrest, you'll also be fined. It's a system of incredibly perverse incentives in New Orleans. I'll talk about that in my last 30 seconds as I'm sprinting toward the finish line. And so there are all sorts of reasons you don't want these folks arrested. And in 2007, the NOPD issued 1,000 summonses and arrested 4,000 people on municipal, low-level municipal charges, so four times the number of arrests as summonses. The city passed two different ordinances that we helped draft and sort of create consensus around that really sort of strongly encouraged the use of summonses, and now that has flipped. Right now there are about 1,000 arrests and about 3,000 summonses. Again, not, know, at some level in the weeds inside baseball change, but, you know, a very big change for the city. And again, the data we use, just descriptive data in this case, right? Very, very helpful for sort of tracking the progress of that. So the thing I'll end with, other than the funding chat, maybe I can talk about LA a little or in question and answer, is the pretrial initiative. That's what we have, a Bureau of Justice Assistance grant for. And that was our sort of third project. We didn't want to start off with pretrial, because we knew that was going to be, as difficult as the other things were, that was going to be a bear, just because it's not only a big piece of work, the politics around it are pretty intense. You know, we had judges, you know, essentially saying, I will never, ever, ever release someone on their recognizance, ever. You can do whatever you want. They will never happen in my courtroom. I must say, I think probably most of the judges said that to us. But there were certainly other people in the city who were interested in doing that. Even maybe some of the judges, although they didn't publicly say that. And, you know, again, that was one of the things that, you know, Vera's done this sort of work for a long time now, and you know, it's the kind of thing that we always think, yeah, but once they start it, we just need a couple of people to start it. You know, we can find somewhere, some judge is going to be receptive to this. And, you know, we just need one or two judges to start. That's our sort of operating theory about how to drive some of this reform. And to BJA's credit or insanity, when you pick, they funded us to start this system. And I think I was telling Chris a story that project started with, we got together a big group of policymakers in the city. So, you know, the usual suspects in some ways. The mayor actually facilitated the meeting, a lot of judges, the sheriff, the police chief, city attorney. I mean, all the people you would think would be there was co-hosted by the mayor and the U.S. attorney there. And Mary Lou Leary came. She was then the deputy working for Lori. And, you know, we had the meeting, and, you know, several people in the meeting expressed their extreme displeasure at the notion that this was going to be forced on the city. You know, what if the city, what if this doesn't work in the city? What if it doesn't, you know, it doesn't have to work here? You've already decided to give us this product. There was a fair amount of yelling. And afterwards, Mary Lou said to me, wow, that was a really bad meeting. It's funny because I said, really? I thought it was great. You know, because in the New Orleans context, it actually wasn't a bad meeting. Although if you never were in a lot of those meetings, you could see how someone would think, God, that was awful. And actually it wasn't awful. People said what they needed to say. A lot of people didn't say anything, which you have to understand in that context. That's a good thing. Right? If they got stuff to say, they'll say it. So not saying it means some kind of tacit approval in the, you know, strange, you know, sort of political world. You know, I mean, everyone was on notice that this was going to be a tough piece of work. And again, a lot of people felt, and sort of still feel, you know, and they'd say very directly, well, what if I decide to release someone and they do like a bad thing? You know, part of me, and this is why my staff doesn't take me to meetings anymore, really, you know, part of me wants to say, well, you're a judge. You know, this is what you do. I mean, then don't be a judge. You know, go run a restaurant. I mean, these are decisions you have to make. I don't. I mean, I am not at the point where I'll actually say that. I just think it. So, you know, we try to explain, well, you know, it's not like it will happen. I mean, it happens now, right? They're doing bad stuff now. You're just not, you know, they're getting out because you can't hold them for a variety of reasons, but we understand the sort of political risk people take. And, you know, part of the value of the Criminal Justice Alliance there is that, you know, there's a sense of sort of shared risk, right? Everyone is buying in now. Is some person going to go out and conk a little old lady on the head and take her pocketbook because you've ROR'd them? Yeah, that's going to happen. But, you know, part of your cover is, you know, You received a recommendation from a professional outside agency. Their best recommendation was to release this person. You released them. It's not, you know, you were doing your job. It's on, yeah, I mean, in this case, it's on us. And so, but again, you know, very serious, very difficult conversations. You know, there's a tremendous amount of research now, obviously, on pretrial practices, and Vera ran the first pretrial program in the country. We've done a lot of that research, but Tim Murray shop NAPSA. I mean, there's a lot of good research on appearance rates, on show up rates, on reoffending, right? And if you do this right, we sort of went over all the research on how well this can work. And again, in their particular case, we had not just us, but people come in talking about what happens if you overpunish low-level offenders and you sort of make them worse. And New Orleans is a prime example of that. They are spending huge amounts of money to create a public safety problem. And they sort of got it. And, you know, they got the message about really concentrating on the worst and violent offenders, because they do have violent offenders. And they don't have a lot of money, and that's where they went. And so they got this at some level. But through the BJA funding, we just started to, you know, the sheriff, who probably in some ways takes the most risk in a lot of these circumstances, built a space for us in the jail. That's where we conduct our interviews. We went live in April, I guess. We only have enough staff to interview people Monday through Friday during the day. We're not remotely set up yet for a 24-hour operation. That will be the next round of BJA funding, I'm sure. We do see 85% of all felonies that come through the system Monday through Friday. And so from I guess the end of May to last month, we assessed about 1,000 people, and about 130 or 140 were in fact ROR'd, right? So it's 13 or 14%? Again, not, you know, compared to DC, where 85% of people get released on some form of recognizance or supervision, right? Not even close to the, you know, well, DC, I suppose, is the best standard for pretrial. You know, New York City does about 60% ROR. So, you know, on the one hand, 14% isn't a lot. On the other hand, it was zero. So for us, it's a start. True to form, there are three or four judges now who, you know, they didn't start to use it initially. They just wanted to see what the information is like. We give them scores on low, medium, and risk. We give them a little narrative report on the person. They like calling in. I mean, this is not a sustainable business model. They like calling in our interview, you know, the people who run this, and talk to us about Joe. Slowly that has sort of disappeared. And, you know, they're just dealing with the paper now. And again, I mean, I don't want to be overly sanguine about this. It's still a very tough issue. We still have a long way to go. But it's clear it's being seen, and in some ways is the way we want it to be seen, which is we're just giving you more information than you had to make better decisions, right? It's not a sentencing grid. You don't have to release anyone. We're just giving you information that you can use to release or not, right? And, you know, starting at about 14%, you know, from our point of view, it's not a bad place to be in the first few months. Still have a long way to go. I need to stop in 2 minutes. You know, one of the things that is an NIJ type project, but it's too expensive for NIJ, is that one of the things we know from New Orleans is that I've never seen a city that is so loaded with financial incentives everywhere in the system that are completely perverse, and that mitigate toward greater incarceration, to more people in jail and prison, to more people under criminal justice control for no good purpose. So I'll give you a couple examples of that. First of all, the jail, I'm sure these are folded into discussions that DOJ is having with the city and the sheriff. The jail is the only jail I know of that's funded on a per diem basis. That is, the sheriff gets, I forget what it is exactly, $23.47 for each body that's in his jail, right? And so he has some interest in having as many bodies in his jail as possible because, you know, that's how he's funded. And the problem the sheriff has is, even in Louisiana, $23 a day is not enough to run a good, safe, constitutional jail. Cannot be done. So you're always chasing your tail. There could be 50,000 people in prison there. He still wouldn't have enough money to run a good, safe, constitutional jail. But that's the dynamic, right? You need more bodies to get more money, but you never have enough money, so you need more bodies. But those incentives are spread all over the system. So even the public defenders get a fee. Every time they take a guilty plea, they get a fee. Right now, no one thinks the public defenders are actively pleading their clients out so they can get, I don't even remember what it is, you know, $35, you know, to some revenue stream. But who would do such a thing? Why would you ever pay a public defender a fee for that? Every low-level case, as I said, every low-level case, simple marijuana possession is the most common arrest charge in New Orleans. And, you know, if you go to, it's not drug court, but if you go to court sort of during drug day, you'll see, what you see is, you know, the defendants, they sort of line up, they're all taking their pleas because they've all been in jail already a long time, and the magistrate, sometimes the judge, usually a magistrate, and I'll stop with this, I'll put off the LA thing, the magistrate will say, all right, you know, it's your first time, first offense, I'm giving you a 6-month sentence, suspended, you know, time served, whatever it is, 2 or 3 years probation, I can't remember, and $1,000 fine. Then he gives them the next, you know, and if you do it again, your second offense gets you 5 years in prison, your third offense gets you 20 years in prison. It's Louisiana, they don't play. So what happens on the fines, right, at some level the fines are seen, they're very politically popular because they're seen as, right, the bad guys are paying for this system. You know, you're a bad guy, you know, you're going to pay for us to move you through the system. But what happens? Of course, what happens is, I mean, $1,000, it might as well be $1 million, it might as well be $100 million, right? These folks are not paying $1,000. It's not going to happen. They may pay 25, they may pay 50, maybe they pay 100. But inevitably, they're not going to pay. And they're going to get a traffic stop, and then they're going to go to prison for not paying that fine, right? So you may collect $50 in court fees, but you're going to spend $50,000 in tax levy money. Now, that's a study we actually have a proposal to do. The problem is, and again, I'm just giving you three examples, that the system is loaded with these examples, right? We have a big cost-benefit capacity at Vera. We'd love to sort of look at the costs. Forget about benefits. Even just the costs of levying these fines and the expenses of when they're not paid. The problem is, of course, there is no administrative data. You can't just sit in the closet and play with data and SQL databases and get it. You have to go into, you know, hundreds of thousands of court files and paper. It's why it would cost a fortune to do this study. It's really, you know, something we're trying to get private money for, but, you know, in some ways that's at the heart of the system. Those financial incentives have long driven how the system operates. And, you know, even with that, you know, this leadership group has sort of overcome a lot of them, but that needs to change in New Orleans for really to be a top flight system. And I'll end with saying that, you know, there are a lot of lessons from this for us, certainly in our sort of small role in this. You know, probably the biggest, and again, it's kind of trite, I suppose, but you know, the sort of catalytic event, right? In this case, Katrina. But sort of local, that local leadership, even though it started with one person but morphed into this group, was just hugely important. I mean, none of that stuff, and I give the city and the parish all the credit for doing all this stuff. You know, they did it at the end of the day. And it's, you know, it's really quite moving in a lot of ways because it's been a very tough process for them. And, you know, I was going to talk about LA. I don't have enough time. You know, they're, you know, in terms of their effort, in terms of the risk they're putting out, in terms of what public officials are laying on the line there to change that system, they're miles ahead of LA, right? I mean, LA needs to change dramatically, right? But there's no push in LA. There's no, you know, you would think realignment might be enough to sort of galvanize people and push, but it hasn't been so far. And the New Orleans folks have really taken this on. You know, they saw maybe through, you know, an event that they would have obviously rather not happened, but they saw this opportunity for reform, right? They saw the door open at some level and they walked through it. And, you know, that's to their credit, but it's really led to some really, you know, hugely interesting reforms. And if other localities or if, you know, people could do work to galvanize other localities like that, I think we could push a lot more of this stuff. But it's been done in a city where it's been hugely difficult to do any reform, you know, for a century. And at some level, if it can be done there, it can be done other places. But it can't be done just by an outside agency coming in and saying we're here to help. They have to own it, and to their credit, they do. So I'll stop there and take any questions.
You talk about the fiscal and disincentives in the system, or incentives being in the wrong place. How much did the fiscal arguments help you persuade the stakeholders there that they had to change, for example, you know, the number of days that people were being held? That's question one. Number two is, how does probation play into all of this? I'm assuming a lot of the people who would be ROR'd are actually on probation. I didn't hear how their data or strategies were in the mix. Thanks.
Sure. Yeah, so on the fiscal stuff, I mean, I'd say it was pretty important. It wasn't, you know, I think certainly the city council and the mayor's office, especially when they're confronted with, you know, their jail has about 2,600. It's now, and it actually was 3,600 a year ago, although I'd like to say it's from all our initiatives. I mean, our stuff is in there somewhere. It's from dropping a lot of state inmates in the federal government for obvious reasons, pulled out a lot of their ICE and federal pretrial inmates. But even at 2,600, you know, if they had the national average of local incarceration rates, that jail would be about 800. And so they're not going to have the national average overnight. I mean, that's not going to happen. But I think people get that, you know, to the extent that you went from 2,600 to 800, even at the ridiculous per diem number, even if you kept that budgeting strategy, that's big money in New Orleans. That's a lot of money. And I think people get that even incrementally, it's a lot of money. It's, you know, what the sheriff is concerned about, and I, you know, I feel his pain at some level. I used to do what he did. You know, he's concerned that, especially because, you know, I'm assuming in the near future there's going to be a consent decree, but, you know, he's concerned that he's going to be under huge pressure, as he should be, to run a good, safe, constitutional jail. And, you know, just because the city saves money, I mean, good for the city. Well, where's my money? And, you know, it's a very interesting dynamic with the sheriff. I'm actually very fond of him. Probably the feeling isn't exactly mutual at the moment, but it, you know, he's an interesting guy. You know, the way he sort of views a lot of this is, you know, before he came into office and before Katrina, there was a longtime sheriff there, Sheriff Vody, right? It's a white guy, right? A white sheriff. He built up that system. That the New Orleans jail system, I think, was before Katrina, may have been 7,500 or 8,000, right? And because it held a ton, and Louisiana holds tons of state inmates at the local level. That's just what they do, right? Them in New Mexico are the leaders in this. It's bad correctional practice, but, you know, but sheriffs make a living off housing, off of holding state inmates. And Votie built huge numbers of prisons for that. So, you know, Votie leaves office, Katrina happens, Sheriff Gussman comes in, who's African-American, and all of a sudden there's all this attention to the, you know, like part of Gussman is thinking, and I get it, like, what, you know, no one said boo when that guy was building up, you know, to 7,000 or 8,000. Like, I'm at 2,600. People are busting my chops, right? And, you know, that's a, he has a legitimate point, but he needs to go down even more. And his concern is how am I going to have enough money, you know, if we do all this good stuff? And the answer is he's not going to have enough money if they keep budgeting him on a per diem basis. They can't budget that way. They have to budget like a real jail, you know, or like any big city agency is budgeted. You're budgeted on your functions and how much security you need and how much programs you need and how much recreation you need, right? He's worried that once you give people the option of not giving them their per diem, they'll give them nothing. And I get that his concern, and this won't work if he's given nothing. And actually, that'll be one of the help from a consent. You know, a consent decree is not going to allow him to be given nothing. So, you know, the fiscal stuff is of more interest to some of those actors than others, but it's been, but doing that sort of cost and potentially cost benefit and cost savings piece has been certainly on the city council and the mayoral side hugely helpful at getting them in. The probation thing is very interesting. It's one of the big pieces of missing data. There's a large segment of that of people in jail are probation violators. We don't quite know how many. We certainly don't know what they're there for violating in the first place. But to their credit, both the state correction and part of it is probation are really interested in doing. Reforming their kind of violation processes to sort of meld with these reforms. But, you know, this is one of the big pieces of missing data there, right? If in a perfect circumstance, we'd see exactly who were there for parole and probation violations, what those violations were for, and we can't. I mean, we could if we, you know, sort of delved into court files, but we can't through the administrative data. So it's probably a bigger issue than we think it is, although the people are at the table themselves, but not enough has happened on the sort of back end of probation and parole.
Hi, it's Jeremy Hale with the Sentencing Project, and I was wondering if you could talk, or if you studied at all racial disparities in the system, and if you have any observations about how race has played a role in sort of the system that exists and any reluctance to reforming it.
Well, I mean, not surprising. I mean, this whole field is about race, right? I mean, it's doesn't matter where you can be a Vermont, and there, you know, there's the racial disproportionalities are huge. So yeah, I mean, and you know, I think even in New York City, I think 93% of the people you see at Raymond are people of color, right? So in New Orleans, I don't know what it is. It's probably 98. I mean, I'm making that up, but it's even more, right? And again, not surprisingly, the communities where there's the most concentration on poverty there, and that, you know, there's huge amounts of concentration of poverty, right? Those are entirely communities of color, and that's who's coming in. That's who's coming into the system. You know, one of the things about even when you're in the system, this was part of Jim Austin's work for NIJ when he was doing one of his population projections, right? He found that controlling for all the usual things, criminal history, instant charge, that black defendants stay twice as long as white defendants. Not a big N of white defendants, but again, those disproportionalities sort of run through the system. Like, I mean, there's no system where that's not true. It's probably more pronounced. In New Orleans, race is just so apparent in every discussion of every issue, understandably, and you see it nowhere to the extent you see it in in New Orleans. And again, I mean, it's both race and class, because those are the folks who are also fined who wind up being in prison, right, for being fined. And so it sort of extends not just the city, obviously, it extends to the state. And, you know, those issues are pretty, you know, policymakers are not, you know, at some level, obviously, you know it. All you have to do is look at your system and, you know, it's filled with black folks. But, you know, things like black people stay twice as long, and, you know, they have higher rates of disproportionality in other places. You know, you would think policymakers would be immune to some of that stuff. And it's actually pretty powerful, right? They're not, you know, they're not completely closed off to those arguments, even though they get it at some level. But yeah, it is a huge and apparent problem in the city.
Tom Feucht, NIJ. Thanks for the talk, Mike. So the cost incentives are really interesting, but I want to ask you about an allusion that you made to public safety. So the idea that somebody who's detained for 45 days or 60 days isn't out doing other stuff. And when you change that and you start turning those charges around faster, or you start settling pretrial disposition quicker, you run the risk that these guys go back out and do more bad stuff. Was that realized, or was that never really a concern, or did you just simply not capture that?
Right. We don't know yet. I mean, you know, one of the things we've been doing is that, you know, is sort of setting ourselves up in all these areas, you know, for ultimately really serious evaluations. I mean, we have some sense early on that they're not going, you know, that the show-up rate is really, I forgot to write it down, but the show-up rate is really high, the rearrest rate still very low, but that, you know, we don't know, and certainly we don't make any pretense to know over time. Both on pretrial and on expedited charging, you know, we're trying to sort of map out sort of research designs now and, you know, think about where data would come from to look at this, because we want to be able to answer those questions not in the way I just answered them, but, you know, with some, you know, with some sort of face validity. And we, you know, I should say, you know, we didn't have enough money. You know, one of the things, I mean, Vera has built a lot of risk instruments in the past, right? We built the original one for the New York City Bail Agency. We just built one 3 years ago for the New York City Family Court to use to make in and out decisions. And that was based on, you know, using hundreds of thousands of cases to predict failure to appear and reoffending. We did not do that in New Orleans. We didn't have the funds to do it. The data exists at some level if someone wanted to give us a huge amount of money to do it. What we did initially was piece together validated risk instruments that have been used in other places. We tried to, you know, intuitively tailor it for New Orleans. We ultimately will, based on that, you know, validate it and rework it. But we did not start with a New Orleans validated instrument. So all these things have yet to, you know, reach the level of an answer I could give you where, you know, with any certainty I can say it's good, bad, or indifferent. I mean, we know those are issues. We know if it's done right, you can overcome those issues. We hope we're doing it right. We don't really know. You know, hopefully, you know, if I give you an update in 2 years, I'll be able to provide you with a more satisfactory answer. But we do know at some point, you know, whether it's us or someone else, right, someone needs to look at these things with a much more sort of scientific eye. And it's not going to be easy, because the data to do that is just going to, even 2 years from now, going to be in rough shape.
Hi, Sarah Schirmer, Mayor's Office in New Orleans. I'm curious on the city side. Vera came in with funding to do a lot of this work, and as you were mentioning, a lot of the data is very bad. You have to go through each person to collect the data. On the city side, when you don't have the opportunity or that time or that funding, how much reform can you really move forward with when you have to put forth so much effort to get the research?
Yeah, it's very difficult. I mean, you know, ultimately the city, and this is easy for me to say because it's not, you know, it's not my money. I mean, look, even a year ago, you know, certainly pre the current mayor, right, the city had no centralized capacity to do any criminal justice planning, right? There was no, I mean, I guess there was a, what's it called, the coordinator's office, whatever, whoever the But there was no sort of policy making at all based on that. I mean, it just didn't exist, right? So now you have an office, you have Carter, right? You have Copland. I mean, people are involved in sort of looking at this, and then they're getting a lot of outside help from Bloomberg and others. But, you know, a basic issue for the city is going to be, you know, it's going to have to find the infrastructure money to create a system like that. I mean, just know you can't do good criminal justice planning of any kind in any sustainable way by having, you know, getting some of that sheriff's data over there, piecing it together with some court data, hoping the DA has some stuff. Let's combine it with the NLP. You know, it can't be done. That, again, that's easy for me to say. It's money and it's politics. You know, it's not gonna happen overnight, and I don't even know what the cost would be. But you know, again, that's why, you know, people have talked about the NOPD consent decree costing $11 million a year. I don't know if that's real or not, but you know, whatever, $11 million a year. The jail consent decree, I don't know what that's going to cost. I don't know, $10 million a year. I mean, I'll just make something up, right? Those are big money numbers, and at a minimum, right, the city, I mean, these consent decrees, I ran a very consent decree jail system. I mean, they're incredibly complicated, and you know, at a minimum, they just have millions of checklists of, I mean, they're way more complicated than that, but things you have to do, you have to keep, you know, you need a, even for that, just that, you're going to need better data than you have now, and certainly to keep pushing the reforms that, you know, the mayor is obviously interested in pushing, you know, he needs a tool. And it's to his credit that he gets whatever he gets by, you know, hook or crook in the force of his personality and a leadership alliance and, you know, bringing people to the table. But you can't, you know, be an executive of a complicated place like New Orleans. You just can't do it with the data that exists now. So, you know, there's nothing particularly satisfying about that answer, and it, you know, maybe it's a $10 million investment. I'm just making up a number. I mean, it's going to be, and again, it's not just money; it's politics, because those systems develop the way they, you know. I don't think people are going to rush and say, "Okay, I'll give up all my data." You know, you do the coordination, but you know, I mean, if anyone could do it, he could probably do it. But you know, you're not going to ultimately, you know, a lot of these are beginning steps. You're not going to get from here to there. Certainly not when you really want to get to the, you know, best practice stuff. You can't have this, you know, decentralized, you know, middling data that you have now.
Thank you for the presentation. Hank Stoinski from Prince George's County. Two questions. What has been the reaction or the response of the community since this has occurred, and what has been the reaction and the response of the people in the criminal justice system to the changes?
Yeah, and I'm probably not in some ways the best person to answer that. I mean, I can tell you that, you know, one of the things that's really helped over the last several years is that the business community has taken a real interest in sort of, I mean, reform generally, but you know, this group and, you know, us through this, I mean, we've done a lot of presentations to business groups and, you know, civic groups, just about the cost of this system, the you know, how much more efficient it could be. And, you know, these groups generally, they may not care about the specific issues of, like, criminal justice or jail overcrowding, but they care about the wise use of taxpayer money and public safety and using limited resources in the most efficient way possible. And it's clear for years it hasn't been done. And so they've been really, I think, helpful in both in their discussions with the city council, with the mayor, and, you know, making sure this reform keeps happening. I mean, they've paid attention, and that's a good thing. There's certainly, you know, there's a variety of advocacy groups, community groups, you know, grassroots types, that, you know, are very energized. Now they're actively involved in, you know, there's all these other discussions about the size of the jail, and there's all sorts of opinions floating around that, I mean, I think generally, and, you know, my sense is the more people talk about this stuff, the better. It's not like there's some broad agreement that everyone's sort of marching in lockstep here, but, you know, the business community generally has been very supportive. There's a lot of grassroots you know, community groups that probably want to see more progress faster and the jail get smaller and more alternative, you know, and I mean, they want all the right stuff at some level, but they do what they do. There's just, I think, a lot more public discourse about this stuff than there has been, and at least from afar, I mean, you work there, so you can be a much better judge. You know, it doesn't seem like particularly toxic discourse. You know, this can be a pretty toxic topic. You know, it's a lot more now than there's been, and people are just paying attention to it. That's a good thing. So I think, you know, there are groups that want the jail to be smaller and want it to happen now, and want to, and that, you know, those are perfectly reasonable discussions to have. But certainly getting in, you know, the business groups has been no, you know, that is no small thing for sort of obvious reasons.
Hi, I'm Phyllis Newton from NIJ. I have a question about the data. You have mentioned several times bad data. Are you talking specifically about the, you mentioned this as well, the coordination of the data among the different agencies? Or are you talking about historic data? Are you talking about individual institutions? When you talk about the problems with the data, can you expand on that just a little bit?
Yes. So yes to every, I mean, there's a variety of problems. So, right, one, they're very sort of disparate systems, right, that don't come close to being a sort of unifying, you know, if you want to see the flow of a person from initial arrest through processing, through the jail, you know, into whatever, municipal or state court, into state prison, you know, you have to look in whatever it is, five different places, and maybe you'll be able to patch together with some guesswork, right, something of how they've moved through. And that's because it's not just that they're disparate data systems. They've all been kind of developed, you know, independently, organically. They have data fields that should be populated, that aren't populated. They have data fields that are populated, but at least we don't understand what they're populated with, right? There's just no, and that's true historically, and probably a little less currently, but and currently, it's a huge problem. And we work in 44 states. God knows how many jurisdictions in those states we were. I mean, we see bad data all the time. It's not, you know, it's just a fact of life. I mean, in some level, no one has really good data, but. You know, there's just so much missing. And, you know, the problem is it's not just like it's one bad administrative data set, but, you know, it that goes from here to there. It's like, I keep saying six, probably more than that, but, you know, six really, really suboptimal data sets that you can't, I mean, I'm sure there are some geniuses who could think about how you would actually, you know, merge them. I mean, you know, I didn't get a chance to talk about it in LA, but our LA work, which in some ways was, there may be, have been larger administrative data projects than our work in LA. I can't imagine there's too many of them because we merged, I think there were nine gigantic administrative data sets with, you know, tens of millions of pieces of information. And that was a nightmare. But, you know, but it was doable, right? You could do it. Now there's a way to sort of track people from here to here. I mean, New Orleans is, you know, they are a long way off. And so part of it is just attention. Part of it is you know, investments in infrastructure. And it's, you know, it's a city with not a lot of money. And then part of it is, you know, I'm used, I was a government official and I work in New York City, right? It's a strong mayoral city. The mayor basically controls everything, right? He wants a soup to nuts thing other than money, he can have it, right? Because he can just tell all his agencies what to do. You know, New Orleans, you know, it's not quite that way, right? I mean, the sheriff is a powerful, independently elected official. The courts are the courts. And so, you know, I think this particular mayor has the sort of gravitas and heft to kind of get that done, but he can't just order it done. And again, it's not, I don't even know the level of investment or work. Is this a 5-year project, a 10-year? I mean, I just don't know. There probably are some people in the mayor's office who do know, but it's essentially yes to all your questions, that even when we're granted access to a data set, which is no small thing, you know, we have you know, there are people that actually know how to do this at Vera. And, you know, I see the look in their face and I don't even want to talk to them, you know, because I know it's just not pretty.